we are at war. And during times of war, we sometimes encounter a foe of gigantic proportions, a pernicious influence that we must battle and defeat to ensure the survival of our way of life, a source of evil we must work tirelessly to root out at its source. Nobody likes being at war all the time, but there are times when a constant state of war is necessary. We'll say we don't like it, and it takes a tremendous amount of energy and resources, but we actually like how busy it keeps us, because it serves several purposes. The main one being that it keeps us from seeing what's really happening on every other front in our lives. The fear engendered by a near constant reference to this evil, this pernicious influence, keeps our attention fixed on prevailing political agendas, which for the last 3,000 years have primarily been about fear. Always we must be vigilant to the threat. Always we must be on guard against the evil around us. And I'm not talking about the current national agenda, and this is not a White House press conference, but it's a useful illustration. The war that the country is engaged in, and even more than the country, but other parts of the world, kind of against terror and against this kind of influence, it's a useful illustration of what I'm talking about. It's a particularly transparent outgrowth of a larger political agenda that predates anyone alive on Earth today. And that agenda is the war on the feminine. We have been waging it for thousands of years. And I think that this version of patriarchy, the kind of particular flavors that it has, is specifically intended to do what it can to debase nature, the feminine, as we have always perceived nature and the earth itself to be feminine. So to start off with some definitions, feminine energy, whenever I talk about it in this work or in this talk, feminine energy is beingness. It just is. It's just-ness. Masculine energy gives direction, shape, and control. So these two together are the fundament of everything that happens in our world. It's just basically talking about how energy is, the two kinds of energy. When I say feminine, I don't mean women. I don't mean literal women. When I say masculine, I don't mean literal men. But of course, it gets carried out to that. When we live in times of duality, which we are, the masculine always dominates, because that's what it does. It attempts to give shape, control, to just the wild thing that is, which is the feminine energy. So this war on the feminine is fought in the collective mind about what nature should be. We deny what it is, and we deny mostly that we are a part of it, and not its master or leader. So this war is fought in and on our bodies. The major example that comes through to me is how we speak when we're talking the language of allopathic medicine, kind of Western MD approach to medicine. That's called allopathic. And you have an illness and you have to fight the illness. You know, this is your body's natural response to some stimulus or some condition, and you have to destroy this thing that's happening in your body. When I started doing this work, it seemed that this destructive version of patriarchy that we're living must be a reaction or a backlash against the destructive form of matriarchy. And then it seemed that any archy we could live, which by definition excludes at least some portion of the populace, absolutely cannot serve us. So that was the first idea that I was thinking, wow, this is so destructive and so specific. It must be a reaction. And I was thinking about how we carry these collective memories of how things were different. So as a specific example, initiation into sexuality, which is initiation into adulthood, and how we feel abandoned because we don't do that. But then it just turns out that it's just that in any time of duality, the masculine will dominate because it's active. The feminine does not dominate because it just is. It is not moving, it just is. It's not trying to control and and give shape to things. So this war on nature, we're all fighting it, we're all wrapped up in it, even if we don't want to be. The way that our minds work, the kinds of lists of vocabulary words for all these different parts of our lives have to do with this kind of battling. When I kind of started figuring this out and realized that I didn't want to live that way, I stopped watching TV and listening to most radio. Stopped reading magazines, and I stopped paying attention to the newspaper because that's the kind of support. This is pretty obvious. This is pretty obvious, but to actually kind of unplug from that kind of social setup is to start to be able to have attention for yourself, because you can't if you're filled with all this stuff about war. Even if we're not actually at war, everything is about conquering and war and fighting and domination. What I envision in doing this Lilith work, and I'm focusing on for a few years, is helping people understand how to stop fighting the war. And a lot of people have done a lot to start doing that. I think Lilith, the archetype of Lilith, gives us more of an opportunity to put words to how we experience that part of the world, how we experience our lives in terms of this kind of fighting nature in this war. So to end the war is what I would love to have people individually choose to do. And, you know, when you're in the mindset of war, you think perhaps that fighting is part of the answer, and it's actually not. Opposing the war in nature is not indirectly fighting the powers on their own terms. One of the examples that comes up to me as kind of a cautionary tale, of a warning, is the anger that defined the women's movement of the 70s. It's playing the same game in the same exact way. Anger does not end violence. Being willing to be violent, even if only energetically, perpetuates violence. So what's needed is a unity consciousness. A lot of us, I think people who would be drawn to this kind of talk would say, well, yeah, of course. Where individuals understand themselves to contain both masculine and feminine energy, and not to fear this, and not to hate themselves for it. Ending the war on nature will be accomplished by individuals learning and committing to caring for themselves, taking responsibility for meeting their own needs. Now, it's caring for yourself, but for yourself as nature, which automatically leads to caring for nature as yourself. The task for us as individuals, basically, is to reclaim a stake in our own lives, to have our own agenda about what we would rather be living, the energy that we would rather put out in the world, and how we'd rather live. So this is done by caring / loving the self into a state of empowerment from which we can make the right choices for ourselves. Being better informed leads to making choices rooted in self-responsibility. And this, by the way, is the spirit of the Aquarian Age being seated here and now, taking responsibility for the self, taking responsibility for our thoughts, feelings, and emotions, the present, but also the past, taking responsibility for everything that's happened to us, thoughts, feelings, emotions, history, all of it, what we've been taught, how we've behaved, that stems from what we were taught, and making different choices. So in this mode, healing is a natural result of accepting responsibility for the self. Not only is the fact of doing so a healing, but doing so opens innumerable doors into seeing what's truly happening, and that also supports healing. This is an ongoing process. It does not happen overnight. There's no magic bullet. There's nothing quick about it. For those not having begun such a journey, it can seem perplexing or daunting or somewhere in between, or a total kind of farcical, otherworldly fantasy kind of talk. Like, what are you talking about? Self-responsibility, taking responsibility for my history. We can talk about that more privately if anybody wants to learn more about that. So in this context, Lilith in the birth chart, the true black moon, represents a dark corner into which we've stuffed the pain from suppression, the pain from not being honored for who we really are, and from rejection for being who we really are, who we naturally are. As we get into the mythology of Lilith, if you know Lilith's story from the Hebrew tradition, so I'm kind of starting in Genesis and then taking, she's not really mentioned, but then taking the commentaries on that over many hundreds of years by the Jewish scholars, they're called Midrashic commentaries, and they're inspired meditations on the actual sacred texts. And they get formalized into a canon of their own. So these are kind of the sources of Judeo-Christian culture for what this Lilith story is all about. one of the things about Lilith is rage, and I want you to remember that all rage is rooted in pain. Conscious work with Lilith is to show how to begin to heal these emotions. The first step in healing is taking responsibility for the existence of these emotions. So Lilith is a shadow. Lilith is a dark corner. We stuff it down in there. We say, this does not exist. This is not a part of us. And then we go home and we're sitting with ourselves and we're like, wow, this is really a part of us. And I don't know how to reconcile that. I don't know how to work with that. I don't know how to deal with that. Healing the fear and anger associated with Lilith is a level of emotional healing we need at the present moment. It's bringing what is unconscious into consciousness. It allows us to remove an inner wall from our psyches and allow ourselves to be more whole. So mostly, I think in our culture, this level of self-awareness is unheard of, but this is kind of our task. I don't know how much anybody in here is thinking about the end of the Mayan calendar, what people were talking about as far as 2012 goes, like what it actually is, what it means. It's if you haven't investigated that and think you might, do not believe that there is a doomsday scenario about to unfold. Do not believe it. The shift that's happening on the planet is from a predominance of male energy, not to one of female energy, but more into balance, more into a unity consciousness instead of the duality. Some people think that the patriarchy sucks, and if the matriarchy were in charge, everything would be fine. It's not true. It's just not true. We shouldn't all be happy because finally the women will be in charge. It's not actually any better than patriarchy. It's just going to have a different kind of suppression and destruction if it were true. And it's not going to happen. Individuals will, in this shift, I believe, start to get more connected to the fact of their true natures and how they really fit into the world at large and how energetically they're a part of everything. Some people say everyone will be psychic. Maybe that's true. It doesn't matter. But this idea of coming back more into balance requires, as a whole and as a planet with people running around who are extensions of the planet, requires individuals to do this. So I think that's really what we're talking about. Yeah, I mean, this is a really important point that we are extensions of the Earth itself, both in body and soul. And I mean, these vehicles are made of materials, pretty much that are from the Earth. And our souls are connected to the Earth. There's something in a branch of astrology called astrocartography, which relates to it's locational astrology. And you look at the globe and you see everybody's individualized chart laid out over the map, and you can say, oh, well, this place really emphasizes Jupiter energy in a positive way, or wow, this place is really not fun for Saturn reasons, or something like that. And kind of look at the world and where you might fit, where you might emphasize certain energies. And the reason this works, that I've never read anywhere, but this is what my gut has told me since I first heard about this, is that the Earth remembers our signature as long as we're here. Our signature being, well, we see it on paper as our birth chart, but our energy signature, that how we were affected by the light when we were born and took our first breath, the Earth remembers that because we are rooted here. We are a part of it. We're part of the world's soul, the Earth's soul. We're extensions of it. So yeah. So healing all the Lilith stuff is about our personal histories. But just as important as this, it's our collective history, our deep memories of seeing and experiencing the feminine being degraded. In the Midrashic text, this is talked about as the diminishment of the feminine. There's a story that the sun and the moon were at war. And to end the war, the moon chose to be diminished and allow the sun to be dominant. And this has everything to do with explaining the shift into the predominance of masculine energy when we came into duality thousands of years ago out of a different kind of consciousness. And this diminishment is said to be the source of Lilith. It's said that there's an evil that arose because of the diminishment, which is basically a resentment, and that's how the Midrashic sources say Lilith was created. All of you have lived lives as men and as women. and you have experienced this diminishment from both sides. So even outside of how you see your present life in terms of this kind of story and how your experiences as a man or a woman, you have been on both sides of it many times, and these energetic shifts on the planet are actually waking up buried memories, and these are some of these buried memories. So I actually see Healing Lilith as an opportunity to kind of get under the surface of all of that. So the way that I talk about Lilith is actually a strategy for adapting to life on Earth over the next few years. As individuals heal themselves, they become conscious of how to bring themselves to the collective as a positive influence. The particular Lilith configuration in your chart is a key to what, relative to this diminishment, both individually and collectively, needs healing, and how you can take yourself into the world to assist the collective and the planetary experience of reintroducing balance. Sounds very lofty, but as you change your behavior and as you see how to participate in the world in a more conscious way based on who you actually are, including this wild primal side of, this instinctive side, is basically, well, it boils down to instinct. As you see that, you're naturally going to see how you can come into the world and start to affect things. This is not, you know, my head's in the clouds thinking that everybody is as much of an idealist as I am. This is actually when this part of you wakes up and is active, this is what naturally wants to happen, because you're a part of everything and you know it. Ending the war on nature then begins inside each person. Individuals taking responsibility for themselves and becoming empowered to care for themselves in appropriate to them ways is the prime answer. It's the only way to end the war. It's true that love is the answer, and yet new levels of clarity on just what love is are needed. At this juncture, the end of the Piscean Age and part of the Kali Yuga, it is tempting to look Kali in the eyes. I found this phrase in a book where this guy at the end of the book said, "Do not look Kali in the eyes. Do not engage aspects of yourself as adversaries. Do not engage yourself through the patriarchal lens that you need to be partitioned off from parts of yourself, or that you should fear your true nature. Do not accept and indulge in the fear surrounding you, even as we experience ongoing large-scale structural changes." That can be related to Pluto's entrance into Capricorn earlier this year, actually. So do not look into Kali's eyes. So now I'm going to go into the myth, unless anybody has any questions about one. I just wanted to throw a bunch of paint on the wall and make a picture for you before we got into the myth itself. I kind of want to do a little context. No questions? Okay, good. So the note on this myth is that all myths are tools of social instruction. Any myth that you look at, you can see it, how it's been shaped to instruct the people in a given culture how they should and shouldn't behave. So I want to go into the myth and kind of break it down by labels we have for the myth and kind of categories of behavior we feel belong to the myth. And then we're going to talk about the archetype as people actually live it. Just to give you a map here. The archetype, and then what healing looks like, and then the astrology of Lilith, and then the example charts. Okay. So this story is based in Genesis, but like I said, is from these other commentaries. God created man and woman. God created man, male and female, he created them, is how it's said. And then there's, you know, stuff happens, all the animals are named, you know, Adam names all the animals. And then Adam feels lonely because all the animals have a mate. And as the animals were processing by him, he felt lonely too. And he said, wow, look, this animal has a mate. And he copulates with all of the animals in turn, trying to figure out which one is his natural mate. And none of them, he's very clear that none of them are. So at the end of all, when they're all named, he says, God, I'm lonely. You know, this stinks, I'm lonely. Every other animal has a mate. So God says, yeah, you're right. Okay, so let's split you in two. Let's just split you in two because you are male and female together. So then you'll be male and you'll be female. And he does this, and the result is Adam is the masculine side and Lilith is the feminine side. So Lilith is Adam's natural other half. That's his natural mate. And the story goes that in their lovemaking, she will not always be on the bottom. She says, we're equals. It's give and take. We're made of the same material. We're made at the exact same time. And he says, no, I'm in control. I'm better because you're made from sediment, which is actually dirty. And he says, I'm made from dust. You're made from sediment. And in these texts, they go to a lot of trouble to explain how that is true. It's absolutely ridiculous. I get incredulous that people buy this stuff and that they have for thousands of years. But so sometimes when I say stuff like that, it sounds like I'm bashing religion. I'm actually not, and I don't want to. I'm just absolutely incredulous that people buy this. So they disagree, and she says, I'm out of here. Forget it. This is not how I'm going to live. She leaves. And, of course, he's sad and lonely. That seems to be a major part of his story. And so he's sad and lonely. He doesn't have anybody to hang out with or to copulate with. And he knows all the animals don't work. And his only natural mate left him. So where she goes, so put a hold on his story. Where she goes is she goes to the edge of the Red Sea. And it's said that demons congregate there. For the purposes of this, I think demons really mean spirits. They are souls, they're spirits. Maybe they're not in bodies, whatever. This is not the demonic, angry edge, evil thing that we've been taught to think it is. This is just there are spirits over there. And she gets it on with all of them. She has hundreds of babies every single day. They're called Lilim, L-I-L-I-M. And they're immortal. They're her creative offspring. What this really means is that she expresses her creativity in the way that works for her. So she, this is sexual. So a lot of the Lilith story is about sexuality, but it's not exclusively sexuality. And this, what I want you to take from this part of the story is that the creativity, she's not willing to give up her creativity and be dominated by somebody else. So her creative expression involves her body. She's connected to nature. She's connected to instinct. She's a part of nature. And she has all these babies. And Adam starts whining to God and says, wow, I'm really lonely. Make her come back. So God sends three angels with difficult-to-pronounce names to bring her back. And they go and they say, we're going to drown you if you don't come back. God said that we can drown you if you don't come back. And she says, no, you can't drown me because God gave me this special job, which was to look out for babies. After she left, it was like what she was asked to do by God. So you can't do that. And they say, oh, wow. So they go back, and then they talk to God, and God says, tell her that if she doesn't come back, her immortal children will be made mortal, and at the end of each day, they will die. So they go back, and they tell her this, and she says, wow, how can I go back to be this guy's slave? Like, now, here I have this my freedom, here I am, I'm living the life, I'm enjoying myself, I'm creative, I'm expressing myself, I'm, you know, absolutely here and living the way I want. How can I go back and be this guy's slave? So she weighs it. You know, she thinks about it. She's thinking about this. Death of her children versus, basically the loss of her autonomy, which is a kind of death. So she says, no, I'm not coming back. So her children start to die. And she goes into grief. And the grief, as in most of us, turns into rage if it sits for a while and we don't do anything about it. So then we have all of these stories. Well, okay. So back to Adam. Sorry, back to Adam. This is important. So it's clear she's not coming back, and Adam says, I'm still lonely. So God says, okay, I'm going to make you another mate. And he makes, he builds like the skeleton of a woman, and then he applies the viscera and the circulatory system and the organs, and he builds her from the ground up in front of Adam. And he says, wow, here's your new mate. And he is so disgusted. He just about retches, and he can't deal with it. He can't deal with it. So God takes her away. We don't know what happened to her. I think this is a really interesting story. God takes her away saying, wow, I made this mistake. I grossed him out. Takes her away. Okay, this time I'll do better. I'm going to wait till you're asleep. and then I'm going to make one, and you won't have to watch it. And you won't have to know what she's really made of. You won't have to see who she really is. And when he's asleep, this is another one of the absurd things, he takes one of Adam's ribs, and he creates this full-on woman out of his rib. And then, you know, sews him up, and then eventually Adam wakes up, and there is this wonderful, submissive, milquetoast, bland, basically energetically, she's like a Barbie doll. She is like half lifeless, totally just wants to make him happy. So she is Eve is the man's idea, the masculine brain idea of what a woman is, meaning should be, but is. And they live happily ever after. It's kind of a joke. They totally don't, because she's unfulfilled, she's bored, he longs for the natural wild, represented by Lilith, who was his actual mate, who was his natural other half. And so here we are. Women in this culture are supposed to be Eve. They're supposed to be like Eve. And men in this culture are supposed to be like Adam. So with the feminine, you have an acceptable the acceptable feminine and the unacceptable feminine. The acceptable feminine being Eve, who will listen to the husband and who will be a good mother. That's what the woman is supposed to be in this culture. And I say this, a lot of people do not have these opinions, but for several thousands of years, this is what we've been teaching ourselves and absorbing it. And in all of our entertainment, these archetypes are coming up. And so this is, you know, even if you were not raised in a religious family of any monotheistic religion or inspired culture, this is a part of what's happening in your brain at some level. So you're supposed to be Adam or Eve. This is actually a quartet. So you have Adam and Eve, and then you have Lilith, and then you have this guy named Samael. And Samael, we know him better after the Christians adapted his story into, his name is Lucifer. That's how we know him. So we have these unacceptable masculine, Lucifer, Samael, and then the unacceptable feminine, Lilith, and then you have the acceptable masculine. So you have this quartet where every man in this culture is supposed to be Adam. He knows he's not. He knows that's not the whole story. And every woman is expected to be Eve, though every single woman knows she is not. So this work is about kind of waking up people to what's really happening and stopping demonizing these parts, because Lucifer is demonized. In the Hebrew tradition, Samael is not demonized. I mean, he's not demonized 10% of what Lucifer gets in the transition. This is an interesting thing. The Hebrew tradition, the Jews have kept in Lilith, in their mythology, in their mythos. They've kept her story. And if you keep her in the story, you have to spend a tremendous amount of energy putting down that energy. Now, what happens in the transition to Christianity is the emphasis on what the demonic is goes from the feminine to the masculine. So now Lucifer gets promoted from, well, he was the guy who was argumentative, and then he left. He gets promoted to, you know, the source of all evil. And he is out to get God and everybody who loves God. You know, that kind of, you know, pernicious influence. He gets a promotion. Yeah, so why are these this particular version of masculinity and femininity, why are they demonized? It's the patriarchal agenda is all about control, because masculinity, at the core of what that energy is about control. We can get angry at the perpetuation of it. We can get angry at the people who represent it, and we can get angry at the people who actually bring that influence to us. And yet, like I said, anger does not end violence. Violence does not end anger. So understanding, we have to understand that control is the ultimate goal, and then to individually choose to kind of unplug and work on that. I want to go back to Lilith's story of what we hear she's all about. And there are four headings that I've put down here. I've taken them from chapter headings from a book called Lilith by a psychoanalyst, a Jungian analyst named Barbara Black Koltuv, K-O-L-T-U-V, that I highly recommend, as long as you don't take in the negativity and don't stare into Callie's eyes. Because what she's saying is, this is how we receive the story, and I'm trying to tell you how it really is. The first one is the diminishment and humiliation and flight. So basically, these are four parts of the story that how we live it. Diminishment, which involves humiliation and flight. She's expected to be diminished, and she says no, and she leaves. The second one is choosing the wilderness, which leads to desolation. She goes off to the edge of the Red Sea, and she's, one of the big parts of this I've left out is that she has to leave home in order to stay true to herself. So you have this flight, this choice of being out in the wilderness with the people who are not your people. You do not belong to these people. She's, in her story, in the mythos, she is with the demons at the edge of the Red Sea. And I said, she's living her life the way she wants, she's having a great time, she's being creative, she's being productive, but the fact is she had to cut herself off from her roots and where she came from, which is difficult. So in that desolation, seeing that, seeing what appears to be a dichotomy, either giving up your autonomy or choosing desolation, comes fiery rage out of that. In this rage, all kinds of people live all kinds of stories. I think a lot of people, a lot of women especially, will relate to this idea of acting from this rage. I think a lot of people do it. I think, so in the story, I'll say more about this, but in the story, from the fiery rage comes the impulse to revenge. And the main headings in this, in the story, is Lilith as the seductress and Lilith as the child killer. She is said to, as revenge, she's said to kill children who do not have a special protection, which is, I think it's saying a prayer over them at a particular time, and it's also having a little amulet or a little necklace, a little charm that has the names of the three angels that were sent by God as the messengers. So her agreement is, I won't kill them, I won't get them, if I see your names on them, and that's the deal. But the seductress thing, Lilith, as we see her in contemporary culture, especially in any kind of, most kinds of storytelling and media that mention Lilith, or very obviously about Lilith, we have this fascination with the wild woman. Like I said, every man who is told he's Adam actually understands that his natural other mate is not Eve, is not the lifeless Barbie doll, but is the wild woman who is Lilith. He knows this. So there's a kind of a container, there's kind of an archetype for acting this out. And when we talk about Lilith, when we talk about Lilith in terms of this, we talk about this wild sexuality that is used as power over men, or even over other women, but sexuality as a tool of power. This is probably the most... See, it could be a bias because I'm a Scorpio and I'm attuned to all of the kind of dark things that are floating around people's consciousness, so I don't want to make some kind of concrete statement. It's one of the two or three main ways that people live out Lilith's story. And the truth is, and this is what we're going to get to with the archetype, that you don't have to choose that. That's like a cultural meme that we've all absorbed and adopted. We don't have to choose that. But a lot of us have, and it's very destructive. There's nothing wrong with seduction, but seduction as a tool of revenge out of anger is a problem. We know that. Yeah. So we're also told that Lilith is about rage. So these behaviors of seductress or child killer or whatever, we're told that it's about rage. And if you look up Lilith almost anywhere, except in some actually poetry, that women who have identified, that I've come across these two longer poems that I can refer you to the books where I found mention of them, but or excerpts and mention, but where they respond and they say, well, actually, this is not evil, this is simply who I am. And so they kind of have a creative response. But have you heard about Lilith? Oh, yeah, she's the demon. She's angry. She kills, people. She seduces men. And that's the meme that's happening, that's floating around in our consciousness, in our collective consciousness, that people download. It's true. There's rage. Like I said, all rage is rooted in pain. And so that's why I'm teaching that we can heal the pain and then figure out what to do proactively, like positively, with this energy to make some kind of contribution. Okay. So let's go into the archetype. What the actual, what the archetypal process is. So everything I just said about the myth, kind of accept that that's what is prevailing in the group mind right now, but let's talk about what the actual archetypal process. I do this with a lot of different myths. I actually write a monthly column called Living Myth, and I take some story and I kind of step into it and say, okay, this is what we think it's about, and then we end up living this story without consciously choosing how we live. So, for example, an Adonis story would be a story of pride. A Lucifer story would be one of rebellion for one reason or another. A Juno story would be a story of, Juno or Hera, would be of absolute commitment and then expecting the other person to respond. So you can do this with every archetype. My goal is to kind of break down the stages of the story. Individuals can then see where they fit in that process, because some of us, let's say there's six stages, some of us will relive three over and over and over again. The whole thing isn't for all of us. Some of us will always jump in number five and derail ourselves in number six. So by understanding it as a process and seeing where that figure who is actually living through us, we are living that story because it's part of this download from the collective, where that figure needs to learn something. What is it that figure needs to learn to make the story not turn out tragic? Because most of our mythologies are cautionary tales about how you should and shouldn't behave. So when we talk about Lilith, I came up with nine stages of this archetype, the first five of which are what is established. The first four are what I'm introducing as the kind of healing attitude about it, the healing approach. So the first one is, you're in some situation and you assert equality. You present yourself as an equal. The second one is, you meet the expectation of inequality. You get denied that recognition and you receive attempts to dominate you. The third one is flight. You leave, you check out, you say, forget this, this is not how I'm going to live, you leave. The fourth one is grief. Like I said, you cut yourself off from where you understand clearly that you belong. The fifth one is rage. Asserting equality, battling attempts to dominate, like meeting these attempts to dominate you. Third is flight, and then grief, and then rage. That's where we are with Lilith right now. That's where we are as a collective with Lilith. These stages are the obvious ones. People living this story very rarely move into the four I'm about to name. These four are the kind of get your ticket early for the Aquarian Age kind of changes that are happening on the planet. That's what the next four are about. Number six, let me just say, so how most people live this story right now is anywhere from 1 through 5. They'll jump in anywhere and cycle through it. you know, from rage we can go back to one. From rage we can go back to asserting equality, insisting on it. We don't typically jump back and forth like 4-2 or 3-2. We don't do that necessarily unless we vacillate in how committed we are to our own autonomy and our experience. So you can see asserting equality and then meeting attempts to dominate you. A lot of people stop there. Not everybody leaves. And if people leave, maybe they don't grieve. Maybe they just leave and drop it and never process anything and never feel what cutting yourself off from where you come from means. Some people never get to rage, even though most of us do, because that's the very convenient kind of prescribed formula. That's how this story ends, with rage. The four that I add, number six is mourning. Grief is where you have the feeling. Mourning, I want to say, is more honoring the fact of what happened. Like, grieving is the... So, right, maybe grieving is the wrong word. Maybe shock is the word, because she's... Yeah, thank you. Okay, good.
Shock is like freezing, and that's like...
That's it.
Freeze.
Thank you, Devorah. Awesome. Thank you. Sure, yeah, I do, actually, because I don't want to forget that, even though it's, you know, my old recording here. Wow, yeah, that's totally it. Thank you. So mourning, feeling the feelings, being in that space of acknowledging the disconnect and how it actually makes you feel. Number seven, accepting responsibility for what's happened. This is one of those things that is not so prevalent, but this is part of this. This is part of my recipe for how to deal with this. This kind of brings in what I think is really happening on Earth, and whether or not you agree with it, we can just agree to kind of accept these stages as I've said them, except for the grief thing, shock. So accepting responsibility for what's happened, you have come here to have certain experiences. If you have come here, like your soul has an agenda, which we see in the birth chart from the standpoint of evolutionary astrology, if you have come here to live a Lilith story, to have a lot of Lilith-inspired experiences, that's what you've come here for, and we have to accept responsibility for it. This is what you are here to experience. For whatever reason, everybody will have a different reason. Based on many factors. Number eight, recommitting to individual priorities. So basically, you have this arc of asserting equality, finding this conflict, leaving, being in shock, anger, mourning, accepting responsibility for what's happened. And okay, well now, what do you really want to have happen now? What would you like to have happen now? Now that all of that's happened and you accept that you're responsible for everything that's happened to you, what next? So the way I've said it is recommitting to individual priorities. It's got to be a better way that doesn't, you know, it's very corporate. There is a better way to say that, and if you have suggestions, I'm totally open. And then number nine, bringing ourselves back to the world. Because much of the Lilith process involves pulling ourselves away from the collective. It's an archetype that we've tried to subdue / eradicate. All archetypes exist in us. There is an inner knowing on the grandest scale that Lilith exists. Some of us identify with her more than others, but this has been a shadow of our cultures for thousands of years, and there's an urgency under the surface to address it. I don't meet anybody that I tell Lilith's story to, that especially a woman, who doesn't identify with it. When we live Lilith's story, we try to reconcile our inner knowing of who we are with what it takes to live with others. Said another way, it's true that we need to honor our true natures, and we need to live in a collective, which sometimes seems to require subduing our individuality. I say seems because it's just that our choice of attitudes, surroundings, and relationships does seem to require that because of how our culture is set up and what we think is happening and how we treat each other. Lilith represents a pulling away from the collective to eliminate conformist messages. So in the unhealthy version of it, you unplug and you isolate. In the healthy version, you pull back and say, okay, no more no more of this influence. I'm going to take care of myself and figure out what's really happening, what I need to do. Lilith energy differs from Uranus in that it's not mental, it's instinctive. I just want to say that because of the note on conformity, conformist messages. It's not just about freedom, it's not an idea, which Uranian stuff tends to be idea-based, and it is really this you know, breaking out of the chains of constriction to have freedom. Lilith involves emotion. So the stakes are, in a sense, higher because she's reinforcing her connection to nature by not denying her true nature. This is the function of her whole being. Her entire project rests on being treated as an equal. Okay. There always exists a collective memory of things our minds have forgotten, of realities that have been edited out of collective memory, or almost so. Yet we remain conscious of these things and of our true natures. We experience cognitive dissonance when we face the reality we know against the reality we're supposed to believe. The worth, the value of the feminine is one of these memories, the place that the feminine can have in the world. Individually, there are people waking up to taking care of themselves, loving themselves in more self-responsible ways, as there have been for a long time. And like I said, collectively, we're shifting from a predominance of the masculine to one that's more in balance. I've been reading lately this interesting book that's kind of opened some doors and helped me understand some of why this has happened. Like, why is this happening? It's Barbara Hand Clough's The Mayan Code. So she's talking about the end of the Mayan calendar in 2012, and she's pulling together the research of a couple of different people, explaining it succinctly because some of it's kind of complex, including like cycles within the calendar and, you know, a lot of math, which I actually can't keep up with, which is kind of funny because I'm still devouring the book. And one of the findings that she reports from somebody else is there's a cataclysm 11,500 years ago, 9,500 before the Common Era, and that this collective memory is suppressed, and that the changes occurring on Earth right now are bringing up all emotions that are suppressed. And we need to uncover whatever these emotional histories are, whatever pain and trauma we're suppressing. So my link to that is that people are hungry to hear a little story because this suppression of emotional stuff, it's becoming, like dealing with it is becoming more and more ripe in more and more people. Okay, so now the note on Lilith for men and Lilith for women. Obviously, most people interested in Lilith are women, yet each person has the true black moon in the natal chart. Understanding the importance of Lilith's primal instinctive wisdom is critical for all of us, yet if you're incarnated here as a woman, you've come here to have a particular kind of relationship with the feminine, obviously to embody it to some degree. You've come here to experience what's happening with the feminine in this time. And if you're alive now and hearing some dude give a talk on Lilith in LA, you're probably here to take some form of active role in healing this cultural rift between the masculine and feminine, helping to restore balance by restoring it in yourself first. Our assumptions about the masculine and feminine are experiments that many of us recognize as having failed to recognize and honor our true natures. So that's what this work is for and about. Lilith as the wild. This, we're easing into the astrology portion of the talk. Lilith represents the part of us still connected to the wild, still carrying it. Whether we express it or suppress it relates to how much external fear of the wild we've internalized. How much about the wild we've absorbed from our environments, because our environments are terrified of the wild, are terrified of anything instinctive and primal. Whether or not we have a lid on our Lilith energy, others can see it in us. If we show it, we present a danger to the local status quo. Could be like local, like family, like mom and dad react a certain way. It doesn't matter. If we hide it, we present a potential danger to that local status quo. People can see it in us. If we have any kind of Lilith activated in us, if it's with sun or moon on an angle, if it's conjunct a personal planet, if it plays into the nodal story, like the nodal structure of the south node of the moon and its ruler or Pluto, so basically we've covered the entire chart, you have Lilith somewhere, probably active, then we present a potential danger. People are afraid that we're going to do something to challenge the status quo. This usually plays out directly in families when we're growing up. The acceptance or rejection of the wild by our families depends on many factors. Most people have somebody who is Lilith-like in the home. Whether or not you have Lilith with the moon, in Cancer, or in the fourth house, the archetype of home and clan and family, depending on how those people are treated, that's a reflection of how the whole family system, as in the inheritance, like how the family responds to the culture over time, like what's happening with that. It's a reflection of it. So healing the wild inside, each of us must take responsibility for what's happened in our lives to us, which is taking a responsibility for our portion of Lilith's rage. The primacy of honoring the needs and realities of the self, which is self-care / self-love, and doing this leads to finding out how, in what ways we're connected to nature, how the wild world informs us from the inside out. This is an instinctive, primal part of us that most of us are mentalized out of even being aware of. How that works for the outside is taking what we've learned about ourselves to others as teachers of some kind, even if it's just leading by example of more bringing ourselves back into balance. You know, every woman has a masculine side and a feminine side, or a masculine and feminine side, and every man has the same. So where you fall on the particular range of one is masculine, one is feminine, wherever you fall in that, to find it and honor that is what I'm talking about. Let's see. First of all, what is the true black moon? Here's my special diagram. E stands for Earth. It's much bigger than M stands for Moon. This is the orbit of the Moon around the Earth. It's never a perfect circle. It's affected by, so you have this route, you know, the expected orbit. It's always, you know, it's a little elliptical, but it's never precisely circular. It's affected by the gravitational pull of the Earth to the Moon. So there's this kind of elliptical thing about it. Wherever, like if you took this orbit and you divided it in half, and you said, oh, whichever side the moon is on of the Earth would fill that because the Earth is going to be closer to the Earth. The other side of it, this is called the, like I suppose the filled focus, or this is called the empty focus. I'm assuming this is called the filled focus. I don't know. Actually, I'm sure it's not. I've never read that or heard that. So, but this is what it is. It's a point. It's not always exactly opposite the moon. I can refer you to technical sources to explain this. I'm not the technician. Okay. So that's what it is. It's a point in space, and it's this kind of, if here's our emotional nature, moon, we see the Earth as our bodies. And then Lilith is this empty point on the other side, this perception of absence. The emotional work to get to Lilith goes through our bodies. I had this inspired revelation of this one day. And when I got this, all these little tumblers started clicking into place because we can talk about Lilith all we want. You can listen to a podcast, you can come to a lecture, you can buy the report, you can come in for a reading and say, I want 100% Lilith. You can read books. The experience, the physical experience of how we suppress or retain or experience these memories, both collectively and individually, is how we get to Lilith from our conscious emotions. It's very important. Okay, pause. Lilith is with my Mercury. So there's a little bit of wildness in how I want to talk, and I always have to kind of calm down a little bit. It's like careening on the highway, you know. It's like, and I have to say, no, okay, it's okay. We can slow down a little bit. We can use the lines as you know. I will say this: the aspects to Lilith. You know, look at the quality of aspect. You know, Lilith is conjunct a planet or point. That energy is fused. You know, sextile, which is roughly 60 degrees, it's stimulatory energy, triggering. The trine is boosting, supporting energy. The square is friction. The opposition is confrontation. So just kind of use those keywords. Transits to Lilith put support or pressure onto this energy in us. If we stifle things down and a slow-moving planet comes along to square Lilith, brings friction to Lilith, we may have eruptions. We may not be able to understand how to deal with things. So these transits to Lilith try to wake up the Lilith via outer events. Progressions to Lilith are indications of the internal dialogues that are shifting about the internal parts of us and Lilith. Okay, example charts?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's go. All right. Are you in there? Is that why you're saying that? Yeah. So I have initials on here. I don't have full names. And also, one note, they're small. Support me in saving paper. I've circled or arrowed out Lilith in each chart, and then in the margins, I've made notes on in my Astro shorthand, using the wonderful symbols of the symbolic language, what's happening in each chart. So if you could just take one and pass them back. And we're going to go alphabetically. Are there any questions so far about any of this, like, the theoretical stuff before we actually get into the charts?
I just want to ask, why is it
engaging with that fear. Engaging with the fear. Letting the gaze of that fear, of that destructive energy, captivate you. So my feeling is you can glance, but if you get locked, you're stuck in fear. You know what I mean? When you're, like, gazing into that. I mean people on Earth right now. Yeah, so I'm not talking to you as a Lilith. I'm talking to you as a person who is experiencing rapid change individually, and we're going to be experiencing much more rapid change collectively. Yeah, thank you.
Do you want to explain to us how you can find Lilith
in your own chart? Yeah, I totally will. I'll tell you right now. I use astro.com.
But is it on astro.com?
Yeah, it is. It is. Right. So, you know, under extended chart selection,
yeah.
The lower left-hand corner, there are two boxes that I'm noting. One of them has maybe 12 now. They keep adding these other bodies. They have some, Chiron, the main asteroid, Sedna, Quar, whatever, how you say that. And in there is a Lilith. That is the mean position of Lilith. Do not use that. That's the Barbie doll. That's the, trying to figure out from a plastic blow-up doll what a real woman is. Don't use that. Go into the box below that, which is enter list of hypothetical bodies and points, where you can enter anything in. H13. That's the true black moon. And then it shows up in the chart as OSC period, which is why I've circled it in all these charts so you can see. OSC period. It stands for osculating, which is the label for the order. Exactly. The position can differ for up to 30 degrees between the mean and the true. So it's absurd to use the mean. You know, because it differs so, because the emotion is so erratic in this business, people say, oh, well, that must not be reliable. But it's actually reflecting the true energy of this archetype. It's a rational, instinctive, primal, irrational thing. Yeah. You can share experiences after we can have a little dialogue about it, or you can not do that. And basically, I'll give you a chance to say something, and if you don't want to do that, you don't have to. So, but I'm going to talk a little about the symbolism, how it shows up, and what it's doing in the chart. So the first chart is AC, which should be on the first page for you. And what we're looking at is the true black moon is at 6 degrees Sagittarius, which is on the IC, in the fourth house, about half a degree from the IC, the bottom of the heaven. It's conjunct Neptune and the IC. It's square the ascendant-descendant axis, and it's trine Mercury-Mars. If you can't follow my shorthand, just follow along with me. Talking about Lilith in the fourth house, this is an inheritance. This is in the family. There is either a support for or a very negative reaction to Lilith, but it's a family theme. It's an inheritance, a family theme. In Sagittarius, we're talking about the expansive, hopeful, risk-taking archetype. As a method, all signs are methods, Sagittarius expands, reaches out, takes risks, and acts on belief. So it's very outgoing. Conjunct Neptune, which is, you know, it's admittedly in the third, but it's just a few degrees away from the IC. Conjunct Neptune, we're talking about, you know, Neptune is the function of us that relates, connects to other kinds of reality, whether that's gambling or inspired creativity, like getting lost in opera music, or some kind of addictive behavior, or just generally speaking, some kind of meditative spiritual approach. That's where her connection to the wild is to be found, is in Neptune on the IC. So just kind of another way of saying this is that where Lilith is to be found in her is with the part of her that accesses other realms and that is rooted in her deepest sense of self. So for her, some kind of meditation practice would bring her back to the wild, her instinct. And also accessing instinct, relying on that, would bring her back to Neptune as well.
Isn't
that
last part
again? Yeah. Accessing the instinct, operating from instinct, letting this Lilith primal side influence her, will bring her back to Neptune as well. These two parts, this Neptune-Lilith, these are fused. They are inseparable. You can't talk to this woman's Neptune without talking to her Lilith as well. So any kind of spirituality that would work for her would involve instinct, primal, connected to instinct in the natural world. Mm-hmm. So like when I see Lilith Neptune, I tell people to, like if they spend any time if they don't spend any time in nature, to go do it. And then if when they do, to open to the messages of what the natural world has to say. This is also something about allowing that like that higher thing that we get to from through our seventh chakra to help us physically, for example, pick food, like a guy being guided by that kind of higher chakra thing. This is square ascendant descendant. And what that means is that the ascendant is, you know, how we show ourselves. The descendant is kind of what we're looking for in other people, how we get to other people. And this means that there is a friction on each of those functions. The kind of way she presents herself and the way that she looks for other people is automatically, undeniably influenced by Lilith. To the degree that she has accepted the labels of Lilith as demon, you know, out for vengeance, even child killer, whatever, seductress, to the extent that she's absorbed the fear around her in the culture, if she thinks that Lilith is a bad thing, what's going to happen is it's going to pressure her relationship choices in destructive ways, because if she's negative about Lilith. As she heals and figures out how to proactively integrate the wild into her behavior and her life choices, then Lilith can, from the inside out, from her deepest foundation, help her choose the right ways of expression, ascendant, and also entering in a relationship, descendant. And the other aspect here is Mercury-Mars, trining Mercury-Mars in Leo in the 11th and 12th. And, you know, the trine is supportive energy, and Lilith brings a visceral creativity. So what we have here is Lilith is at the bottom of the chart, in the most, basically the most private place in the chart in this person's life, trining, supporting this Mars, Mercury, and Leo, which wants to be very expressive, you know. Not just Mercury and Leo, but Mars added to it. There's some energy-inducing food supplements and chlorella added to this Mercury. You know what I mean? Like it wants to go and it wants to do and it's highly energized. So for her, the relationship of, you know, what her mind is doing and where her, you know, intellectual, mental, verbal attention goes, is influenced by what's happening in this inner connection to instinct. If she's looking at Lilith as the demon, then her Mars, Mercury, and Leo in the 11th and 12th is gonna reflect that, because the trine is a supportive energy. Now, we can support each other in doing well, being productive, and we can support each other in, you know, being lazy and destructive. So it's a supportive thing. Whatever is happening with that Lilith is going to be supported by the Mars Mercury, by this very creative, this interested in being very creative, creative expression energy. Do you have any questions on this chart? Does anybody have any questions on this chart? Because it might be that once we cycle through the example charts, other questions come up. Like, oh, well, in this chart you said that, but in that chart you said that. So maybe letting my Lilith Mercury jump around might work. Are there any questions about this or any? Okay, everyone's eagerly looking at their own. So the next chart right next to it, CG. This is in Scorpio in the 8th house. The aspects are square Venus-Pluto, which are in Leo in the 5th, and sextile the South Node, which is in Capricorn in the 10th. So here we'll get an example of how it ties into nodal stories and nodal structures, which are about our conditioning from other lives and then how we recreate that now so we're in certain themes to learn things. So the method, Scorpio, is in penetration, is in getting below the surface. Whatever's happening, Scorpio wants to find out what's happening underneath it. It's about understanding, and it's about relating emotionally as close as we can to another thing, person, or idea. You can be Scorpio with an idea by bonding with that idea and taking it in and really like getting close to it. It doesn't have to be another person. And then we have the 8th house, which is related to Scorpio. And so this house is the arena of life that involves all of that penetration stuff. So this is honesty between people. This is intimacy. This is where we share things with other people, where we share, you know, the traditional thing is shared resources, you know, shared money, other people's money. So we're talking, so this is going to play out a lot in this person's life in intimacy. What it means is, I mean, I think what happens with this, I just got some feedback today from somebody who ordered the report and said that thing about Lilith and Scorpio is what I've experienced. Like, that is the key to what I've experienced. So that gives me, like, an idea that I'm onto something here with this. Lilith and Scorpio in the 8th, the wildness is available to be seen in the most vulnerable moments in the person. The most, when that person is being absolutely as honest as possible, as emotionally available, as emotionally naked as possible, that's where Lilith is. What happens, I think, in these people's experience is other people, we don't know sometimes that other people can't deal with Lilith. So the lights are turned down, we're relating to each other in an 8th house way, there's maybe some intimacy, and then there is the instinctive side. People flip out. Because it's in the 8th house, it's not readily visible to everybody all the time. So the people that we can be with might not ever see it coming. If they react, oh, what was that? We're the most vulnerable that we've ever been with that person. And we're going to feel that much more. So that's going to inspire us. And this can be honesty between a parent and a child. This can be when you're 6 years old and you really have something that you need to share. And what you share is taboo. And your mother or father says, we don't talk like that. You know, that can, maybe there's a punishment, maybe there's something that's going to teach you not to be that vulnerable. Square Pluto-Venus in Leo in the 5th. Square is friction. Pluto, Venus, and Libra in the fifth. The Pluto in the evolutionary astrology, I take it to stand simultaneously, to represent simultaneously, the deepest intentions and desires of the soul and the deepest wounding of the soul. I see them wrapped up together. I actually see, when I do this work, I see a golden ball of happy, shiny, liquid, wonderful, loving goo, which is the Pluto desires and intentions, the gift that we want to give the world, the kind of experience we want to have on Earth, the kind of thing we would love to major in successfully, covered by the crust of experience that we get from being vulnerable by really, really wanting something and then it doesn't work out. So I see them as, I see those two things as related. The first idea, the intentions and desires, is the Jeff Green idea, one of the guys who developed this paradigm. Separately, Steve Forrest developed the paradigm and says it's the deepest wounding of the soul. When they get together, they realize they're talking exactly about the same thing. They just get there very differently, and I combine those two phrases. So Pluto, Venus, and Leo in the fifth has a lot to say about a deep soul need to express creativity. And to express creativity with other people, this whole Venus, this aspect. So there's creativity, but there's also this desire to share this with other people. So this has a thing to say about being, like the creative voice being heard. That. Square, Lilith, in Scorpio in the eighth, we're talking about friction between the vulnerability, the place that, you know, in the most vulnerable times, that's where Lilith is, and then you have this in friction with this desire to create. So the picture I get is of pursuing creative expression, and yet always knowing that it's about on the verge of showing too much. If I really get up there, and let's say it's painting. If I really, really express what it is, what's really happening for me, and then I show people, because I desire to be heard, they're going to really see what's happening inside. And I've had this experience, and I'm terrified of really showing that. So that's kind of like the pre-empowered dynamic. How it works when there's some healing that's happened, it can be that each of those things, this Lilith in the eighth, this kind of business about vulnerability, and then this creative expression in the fifth, and this desire to share, to really be heard and really share the creative side with other people, and to play and have fun, but being serious about playing and having fun, because we're talking about Pluto in the fifth, that they drive each other. That intimacy inspires creativity, and creativity inspires intimacy. And allowing those two to affect each other, allowing those two parts of life to affect each other. If the people can look at Lilith with open eyes, and at the same time, because we're talking about Lilith and Pluto, two things that in our culture become shadows, things we don't look at. If they're willing to see the wild primal thing in the self, and if he or she is willing to understand the importance, the high stakes of this Pluto business, this Pluto, Venus, Leo, fifth business, and consciously do something about it, even though it can hurt to really be seen. I mean, part of this wounding is about not being seen, you know? So, and then it always stirs up the Lilith stuff. And then sextile the south node. Any energy that's sextile the south node, that represents the south node, in just a really brief shorthand, is the repository of our emotional memories from past lives. It tells us our conditioning in a series of past lives represented by this chart, which focuses on certain themes. Because you've had many, many lives, and maybe the life after this one, you won't have a chart that reflects the themes of this life, because right now this is what you need to work on. But maybe, you know, when you come back in 80 years, maybe it's something else. And so you might have a different chart. So, but the south node of any given set of lives that we're working on, the themes of that, working on healing. So this south node is Capricorn in the 10th house. So there's, you know, the 10th house is a public life. Capricorn is this... the method of maturation, of being responsible. It's less, let's see, I want to say duty, but that's not it. It's kind of an obligation to it, but there's a parental responsibility kind of nurturer, kind of concrete nurturing as part is the Capricorn thing. So whatever was happening for this person in that environment, whatever environments, you know, he or she experienced, it was triggered by Lilith Energy. So you have to, we're reading the chart on two levels, that personally speaking, you know, it's square the Pluto, square the personal wound, but then also sextile the South Node. Something Lilith involved is stimulating the environment that she's coming from. So if it's negative, you know, the wild is destructive. You know, if it's positive, the wild, you know, the wild is tickling and poking and triggering, like triggering action. I don't want to get too much into that because it really brings up, you know, the whole nodal structure thing, which is a lot. I think though, kind of focusing on that Venus Pluto square to Lilith is probably the core of what should be talked about anyway. So, any questions about this chart at all, or comments from the person it belongs to? Say more.
Well, just the fact that Pluto and Venus are conjunct is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Venus is another feminine we're not the one we're familiar with. Mm-hmm. So that aspect of Venus to Lilith. And being squared, I mean, apparently really highlight and very big way of femininity of the times.
Oh, the femininity? I mean, that's what you said, right? Yes, whether or not, like, whatever, and whatever ways it's expressed, yes. Meaning that person has all the choice in the world about how that works. You know, is a person really, really feminine? Is a person not that feminine? But yes, it raises the stakes. It makes it really, really important. And it does definitely influence that, yeah. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, yeah, I mean, like that phrase of the stakes being high keeps coming back to me, you know? But the person knows that engaging in one activity or the other, whether it's a fifth house thing or an eighth house thing, is gonna bring all this stuff up. So yeah, it's like a, you know, for the more psychologically oriented person, it's a gold mine, you know what I mean?
A major work of the life.
It's a major work of the life, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I would say that's really true.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to put anybody on the spot, so.
No, it's
yeah.
Okay, but I have to do creative stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of, because the past has a lot of suppression of that energy, too.
Right.
So it tends to either really play out or not.
Right. Either the brakes are really on because you do not want to be, it's rejection and it's abuse. You don't want that, so you're like, no. But I mean, you'll feel rejection as abuse. Rejection is probably more of a thing in here than actual abuse. You'll feel it very deeply. You feel rejection. You know what I mean? Like the kind of taking personally. Because
there's always that tinge of like a lot of kind of energy and creative that I'm involved in.
Exactly.
There.
Right. Now, that said, you have the choice. You can choose not to be creative, right? Like anybody can choose. No. Everybody, you can shut down. Everybody can shut down, check out, numb out, addict him or herself out of having to face this. I mean, so I acknowledge that you do it anyway, because you know you can't, because that reflects a commitment to yourself, as far as I'm concerned. You know what I mean? It reflects a commitment to yourself, because you can choose not to do it.
Yeah.
You know, millions of people choose not to do it.
Well, I'll put myself in the environments as best I can.
Exactly. Well, because you're more willing to learn. You're more willing to see it. And I think, like, I know her. We've worked together before, and we're friends. I think you like being here. You know what I mean? Like, you like being on Earth. Like, you like being... Some people who would rather not be here would not be putting themselves in this situation. Because it is very heavy. A major life work, you know, is the worst. Yeah. 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 Thank you. Moving on. So DC is the next chart. We have True Black Moon in Lilith in the ninth house. It's just you know, what is it, a degree or two from the ninth. I'm going to read it in the ninth and not in the eighth. And I could be wrong about that, but it just feels better. I don't know. It feels more right. It's conjunct Neptune. It's sextile Pluto. It's square the ascendant-descendant axis, which means it's square Chiron and square the south node. And it's actually, and it's in a square to Uranus too. So this is a chart with a lot of keywords, a lot of nugget phrases to list. So Libra in the ninth house, is a person this chart belongs to comfortable talking about it? Okay, well, just because I have a question. Do you, knowing what you know about Lilith, do you read it in the 8th or 9th? Would you read it? Your experience is going to trump my assumption, you know?
I mean, I think it's appropriate that it's on the cusp.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like, I take it from the personal to the super personal.
Yes. Okay, thank you. So the keyword list will get longer. Okay, so in the eighth, we just covered that in the eighth, a little built-in efficiency about when we really show ourselves to another person. This is also, she has a Virgo moon in the eighth, so there's also, you know, and Pluto in the seventh. So there's this need and an interest, a desire to meet the other. So, with Neptune, again, another resonance from the first chart, how Devora connects to higher realms. So whatever is happening, and is that retro? It is retrograde. The Neptune's retrograde. That's interesting. That's Neptune's retrograde. And it's square the nodes. Oh. So you were... At some point, you allowed yourself to get conditioned out of being instinctive, religiously conditioned out of being instinctive, and now you're recovering because that Neptune's retrograde. At some point. But you never forgot it. You just allowed your behavior to be modified. Because I look at you and I know you never forgot it. You know? Okay, so with the Neptune, again, the direct connection to the divine is wrapped up in her instinct informs that. In Libra, we're talking about Libra's method is about figuring out moderation, trying to find the middle ground, the middle road. So typically, especially when things are in Libra that are involved in the nodal structure, and in this case it is because these two things square the south node and square the nodes, there's a history of extremity, of extremism, of really doing something a lot or not really doing it at all. So Libra trying to learn balance. So we read it in the eighth. We'll read it in the ninth. The ninth is the arenas of life where we develop some kind of overarching guiding principle, philosophies, belief systems, religions. So this Neptune Lilith, you know, maybe Lilith pulls Neptune into the eighth a little bit, like she said, making the personal. Not sure if you said transpersonal, but making the personal bigger, super personal. Thank you, and pulling Lilith into the house of belief system. Square the south node means that the response to instinct in the past lives was experienced in a way the choices were made that feel like they didn't serve her, like the word that. The word that I've heard that I like latching onto is vexation for something square the nodes. So we understand something about it. It's a part of our lives. But the choices we make about it don't serve us. Maybe get us into trouble. Maybe end our lives. But basically, we don't feel like we get something. We have to learn in this life or in any life to make different choices about that energy. So for her, square the node, she's got to... this is about aligning... This is about a moderation of aligning her instinct with her spiritual self. So does her instinct let her pick what ritual part of her life she engages in? You know, is she going with a kind of an earth religion kind of flavor, or is she kind of trying to deny it and going with a kind of consensus Neptune idea? So this kind of like, where is she choosing to fall on how she experiences your spirituality? Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Yeah, you're just taking it in. Okay. So, and this is square Chiron. Chiron's on the ascendant and the north node. And so you can say in the past, this kind of spiritual life and the reasons behind it, which is a ninth house thing, existed in... Well, okay, when something's on the north node, it's far from us in the karmic past. When something is on the north node, it is as far in the chart as possible from the south node, which is the environment we're coming from. So this square indicates that there were choices that didn't work regarding spirituality and religion and philosophy and belief and how they were chosen. And then there's also this lack of Chiron in Capricorn in the 12th, just above the horizon, which is very kind of a strong placement, just above the horizon. That's so. There's this conflict built into her own self-expression. When I see this, I see the right that you perceived that you had to truly express your unique individuality. Because one of the things about Chiron is this uniqueness, this individuality. It's the wounded healer and all that. But there's also this issue of, well, I'm different, and I'm different for reasons, and there's nothing wrong with those reasons, even if you tell me that there's something wrong with me. So the next page, is LM here? You are here, and you're totally on board with sharing. Awesome.
I'm on board with sharing. I don't do any of the stuff you do. So.
That's cool. No worries. Okay. Okay, it's in Pisces in the 7th, and it's involved in a small pileup with the retrograde Mercury and Chiron and Saturn and the descendant all in Pisces.
Where is it, right in the middle?
Yeah, it's right in the middle. You can see my arrow going to the... It's at 24, Pisces 14, if you can discern from the pileup. Yeah. It's a concentration of energy. We have a lot of bodies close to each other. They're fused and merged. And the house that they're in represents the arena of life where all that, all those storylines play out, all that interest and drama plays out. And for you, it's in the house of other people. So this emphasis on the seventh house means developing harmony, fairness, learning what it means to exist peacefully with other people, yet be adequately represented. So the seventh house, balance, fairness. Okay. So, conjunct Chiron, Saturn, descendant, and Mercury. You know, treating them all kind of together. Chiron is this kind of wounded healer thing, but it's also this individuality, uniqueness thing. Saturn is the authority function in us, the part of us that says, well, if you have to get up at 5 tomorrow, you better go to bed at an appropriate time tonight. This kind of inner disciplinarian, the inner father figure.
And that was retrograde, right?
Is it? No, it's direct. It's direct, but there's nothing wrong with it if it were retrograde. The Mercury's retrograde. So, and then it's with Mercury, and that's retrograde. So the Mercury is perception, thought, communication, the way your mind works, but what you're actually interested in as well. How you think, what you're interested in thinking about, how you communicate. But it really colors the lens of perception is probably the baseline of it, whatever is touching Mercury. And then the descendant, the beginning of the seventh house. So we're looking at, the house of other people. These four together are in Pisces in the seventh house. Let me see if are they involved in the nodal structure? No, not really. No. So some of them are kind of opposed Pluto, which makes them count, but... Oh, and then, yeah, and then these are... Okay, hold on one second. Pisces as a method, all signs are methods, is about opening to the greater reality. You have a sense of ego, you have a sense of self, individuatedness, and yet there is a greater reality around you. Whatever's in Pisces is trying to somehow connect to that reality. And so with Mercury, Chiron, and Saturn, we're talking in Pisces in the seventh with Lilith, we're talking about the instinct, the primal instinctive wild side of Lilith is influencing your thought, what you think maturity is, and how you approach healing. So like I said, what you're interested in. So for you, it's also trine that Neptune. So these exist, and Neptune rules Pisces, so there's this kind of conversation between Neptune and the third. You know, this is a part of how your mind, you know, how your mind works, which is supporting this Mercury in Pisces. So there's a, you know, there's a trading of influences there, and a supportive conversation. It's opposing Pluto Uranus, which are in the 12th, and they're pretty tight, and they're both retrograde, just above the ascendant in the 12th. So, you know, like I said, Pluto has to do with this karmic wounding, but also our soul's deepest intentions. So yours is Pluto Uranus and Virgo in the 12th. One way, a very broad stroke way of looking at that is that one of the deepest desires and intentions of your soul is to bring some kind of innovation to the world from the ethers, right? It's from the 12th, this place where more exists than just you as an individual. Opposing. So what this? So opposing this business in Pisces 7. So Lilith, in opposition to Pluto, brings in the instinctive wild, is related to the wounding. So, but also the desires. They're in confrontation. The things in opposition are in confrontation with each other. So the high side of it is, you and I are different. This is like an opposition, right? We're facing each other. You and I are different. I can see you. You can see me. I see how you're different than me. I don't have to criticize you, but we can choose to remain in conflict because we're different. Or we can say, great, you see me, I see you, maybe we can learn from each other. So for you, there's all this stuff in the 7th opposing this wounding in the 12th, this Pluto in the 12th. There's a conversation about, what is it? It's like, I'm just about to get it. There's a conversation between how you interact with other people. You'd rather be wild. You'd rather be instinctive. You'd rather be instinctive and primal, but it's kind of gotten you in trouble so that you don't get to manifest what you really want to manifest. It could be that you have manifested chaos and couldn't achieve your goals. It could be something like that. Is that, that seems like it's hitting kind of like, because the Pisces thing can be all over the place, you know, Pisces. It's also square Jupiter, which is in Gemini in the 10th, and the MC, the midheaven axis. And actually, that's a T-square, right? That's a T-square with the Pluto. So so Lilith square Jupiter, Lilith in the 7th, Jupiter in the 10th, is a conversation about how you can't have a happy place in public if you really show the wild that's in you. And that is involved in a conversation with the soul's wounding, which is about a big agenda, affecting something on a big scale. That's kind of revolutionary, probably healing-oriented. So for you, Lilith in the 7th, one of the things about Lilith in the 7th is that we find it in other people. So you need to learn to integrate it. You need to say, yeah, where am I wild? How am I wild? It's not only when I'm with other people. It's not something that I should put on other people or expect other people to help me bring out. So finding the wild in you is how to release some of this tension and kind of resolve this big argument that might get in your way a little bit. Do you have any questions about that or comments?
No, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anything else?
No.
My chart. No. Okay. What about MD? Nope. Then I guess it's SK. Yay. Okay, and you're very eager to share too. Okay, great. Of course, you guys sat in the front row, right? Okay, so true Black Moon Lilith in Leo in the 10th house. This is sextile the ascendant and trine the descendant. It's trine Chiron in Pisces right on the descendant, and then it's trine Mars, and then sextile Jupiter-Uranus conjunction. So Leo in the 10th house. 10th house, we're talking about place in the world. We hear it's about work. It might not be about work, but it's maybe how we would like to have our outer life go. It's kind of how we are outside the home. So it can be about community involvement. It can be about how we make our money. It doesn't have to be. In Leo, we're talking about expressiveness, expression. So what I didn't do in some of these charts, and if you want me to do it, ask me when we're done with this one, but basically say, what is the method? So what is suppressed? You know, what is the arena of life? So what is avoided? So with Leo, the method of Leo is in one sense, it's sharing, right? It's performing. It's like, it's performing the experience of being me is what Leo wants to do. And Yeah, well, the creative side of us, yeah. Yeah, definitely. If you really got into the creativity side of this, we'd look at Venus, we'd look at the 5th house, we'd look at the 2nd house, we'd look at all the, you know, Taurus, all this stuff. But just basically speaking, this like public presentation of yourself as a creative being is what has been, what has made some people uncomfortable. So maybe when you're a little girl and you're in the school musical, and it's just the way you hit that last note on the song, and some people's like, oh, I don't know, that's a little too expressive. You know, that kind of like some kind of something about you creatively expressing yourself publicly that is that makes other people nervous. Right? Do you have any experiences like that? Do you have any?
Like at the dinner table where I start speaking, I can just feel like I'm just going to like go and say something. Like,
right. So your mom's a teacher for you to teach you how to be quiet so that later you can learn how to transcend it, right? Get out of that. So Lilith in the 10th in Leo, sextile the ascendant and descendant, you know, triggering the ascendant. So, yeah, so talkative, this outgoing Libra thing. You know, because Libra wants to share, Libra wants to interact and relate. So, and then trying the descendant with Chiron right on it, you know, there's a sensitivity in that Chiron in Aries right on the descendant. Yours is just from the 6, but whatever, it's on the descendant. Reading it, I'll read it in both houses a little bit. So the feedback that you get, so basically Lilith and Chiron in a trine are going to boost your sensitivity to other people's reactions, because this Chiron is in the 7th. You're going to see, you don't want other people to be uncomfortable. Right? Libra ascendant, Chiron on the Aries descendant. You don't want other people to be uncomfortable. So you'll edit that. You'll edit that kind of boisterous public thing. Let's try and Mars in Sagittarius in the 3rd. And I know that is square your nodal axis too. So this trine, you know, Sagittarius in the 3rd is another one of these you know, influences of outgoing verbalness, right? Mars in the 3rd, the house of communication, and Sagittarius, kind of an outgoing thing, expansive. So, I mean, I guess as I look at it, we're talking almost about a grand trine, right? I don't know if it's out of orbit. Let's see, trine 8 degrees. I'd count it. I think I'd count it, maybe 8 degrees, with the Chiron in Aries, Mars and Sag, and this Lilith in the 10th. So that's like the energy wanting to build. It's wanting to build, right? And you want to take it to other people. You want to show it publicly. You want to perform the experience of being a human, right? And but you don't want other people to be uncomfortable, so you'll edit it that way. But the instinct for you instinct needs to guide your expression, because we're talking about this seventh house thing, but also this this other people's suffering meter, Chiron on the descendant, with your Mars and Sagittarius, kind of your urge to speak your will, to act out that way, to behave that way. Instinct needs to be recovered for you in being willing to be seen in public as Lilith, as somebody who's connected to instinct, as somebody who's primal, as somebody who is not denying her own true nature, and a Leo who is willing to creatively express it in some way. Mm-hmm. So the instinct needs to come back to how you devise public selves, like public personas. Now, what you actually do in the world should be influenced by this. I mean, we should go that far and say, maybe not how you actually work, but maybe how you choose a work, how you choose your place in the world should be informed by that primal instinct. So like for you, if you really listen to that, your work is going to end up serving this earth healing process, because that your connection to the wild is to be found in a public performative way, public sharing way. And then sextile, this Jupiter-Uranus, which are just above the horizon, again, with the ascendant. It's triggering this, Jupiter on the, what is it, a degree from the ascendant. Again, anything that is just rising has symbolically just, kind of like this ascendant, what this is where the sun on the day you were born, this is the eastern horizon on the day you were born. If you were born at dawn, the sun would be there. So this is what is just coming up into the light on the day you were born, whatever is there. So anything that's like a degree or two just above the horizon is elevated in importance, because it is being seen. Now, as we experience it personally, it's in the 12th house. Maybe we don't always know how to put our finger on it. But for you, there's an element here of trusting this, this Jupiter-Uranus in 12. It says something about the intuitive flashes that you might get existing in a stimulating energy with this public role of yours that's informed by instinct, if that makes sense. And it's kind of vague and broad. But there's an intuitive flash thing about Jupiter-Uranus in the 12th that should inform... Yeah, so this intuitive thing should inform who you are in public. Well, I mean, one way this can play out is, well, I know I'm not Eve. I know that. My intuition tells me. But here I am, trying not to make other people suffer, so I'm never going to be Lilith. Do you have any questions or comments about that, SK? No? Okay, so any other questions about any of this, either revisiting one of the example charts for maybe, for the next 5 minutes or anything? Yeah.
I guess there are three of us who had some aspect with Uranus. And what's interesting is that Uranus seems to be a chair with Lilith in terms of it. Maybe wants more, Uranus is maybe more the intellectual side of uniqueness, individuality.
Yeah.
Just being outside the box.
Right.
And Lilith is the emotional or physical, manifestation, instinctive manifestation of that.
Definitely.
So, when there are hard aspects to each other, it seems like a hard aspect is something that is naturally almost in harmony with each other.
Yeah.
That opposition or complication or friction would be highlighting the differences between the body and the mind.
Yes.
Or the emotions in the mind, or something like that.
How they can be in conflict. Let's say they're square.
And it's still the same process of separating themselves out from society's status quo.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of almost like teasing out something important there.
So the reasons are different. The reason each body would break away are different. And the symbolism of the house and sign are different, and the aspect, right, completes that, how you create the dialogue. But yeah, they have different reasons, because Uranus is never, lower chakra is never heart, you know, Uranus is never in the body, and Lilith is not an idea, it's not that mental process. And Lilith doesn't say... Yeah, or even Uranus can be that intuitive flash, right? That intuitive knowing. But Lilith is that whole body, visceral knowing. Huh?
But they get their different flashes, but they get their different...
Yeah, because Lilith is not a thought. Uranus is like, wait, but I was thinking about this, and that's not right. And Lilith is like, rawr! We're living within this Saturnian container, right? We're living within Saturn-inspired, right? All groups, all cultures, normative living, right? Norms, Saturn. So Uranus would be the anti-Saturn, and I keep thinking Lilith is the pre-Saturn. Lilith is before Lilith, the instinctive response.
Before getting civilized to death.
Right. So when we break away, we say, yeah, the way you're trying to civilize me is not okay. And it's a whole being, whole body, visceral, lower chakra, no. And then this Uranian thing is, yeah, figuring out
then
what freedom is.
That,
huh?
Then they're done that,
yeah, exactly. So anti-Saturn, like, okay, no, your rules do not work. And this Lilith thing is like this total visceral rejection of the container. So they're different. It's versus the idea versus the whole visceral response.
But like what you did on my report on the transits.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a Saturn transiting Lilith.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to do with finding, socially acceptable. How do you say ways of expressing Lilith?
Yeah, so you're challenged with making some kind of structural container or some kind of
order.
To make sure that order that would create space for that Lilith. And so for you, it's like transiting, where it's transiting the sixth and it's sextiling, right? It's transiting, I mean, I'm looking at your chart now, but it's transiting the sixth, and what is it, like at eight Virgo and things at six Scorpio. So, so you're challenged to work to kind of introduce into routine, right? Sixth house. Create routines. And it might take work. It might take hard work and responsibility and new levels of maturity for the parts of you that resisted. You know, there might be inner little girls who are, no, I don't want to do that. Creating opportunities for you to do this eighth house sharing. But it doesn't happen without work to create the container. Right. So, yeah, so it's resisting Saturn, but then you, as it transits it, have the responsibility of doing that for yourself, of figuring out a new Saturn way of something. Yeah. Thank you. Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.